Okay, welcome back to another Throttle Up radio show and podcast. I'm your host here behind the microphone, Captain Kevin Smith, U.S. Navy retired and currently an author and a speaker. Also, I do some design consulting as well. Now, we are in the middle of a special edition, and of course we do special editions on a regular basis because this is not an ordinary radio show. This is something different. It is, I guess you could say, it's a bit out of the box in terms of normality, but it is different, and we want it to be different, and want it to be also, because of that, we want it to be engaging and we want it to be informative. We want to inspire and inform is primarily what we are trying to do. And so this special edition is related to what we call a theory of knowledge and a theory of truth. Now, that sounds a little bit bizarre, I know. But there is such a thing as the theory of knowledge, and there is such a thing as the theory of truth. This comes from kind of like a hybrid discipline. It comes in part from the discipline that we call critical thinking. Critical thinking also relates directly to complex problem solving. There are some differences between the two. There's not a lot, but there are some differences. And we covered this in our, in fact, there is a pretty good video that we have posted on YouTube that addresses itself to this very issue, critical thinking and complex problem solving. The YouTube channel that it is on right now is called The Sonic Warrior. So you can go there and you can get that. We'll try to also post this on our Facebook page and other places where you can go to watch this video. It's we think it's a pretty good video, actually. It's professionally produced, and it was produced on location at the Air and Space Museum in Denver. So we like this video a lot, and it deals with critical thinking and complex problem solving as a related subject, and it is closely related to this, is the theory of knowledge. It is part of the whole large or big picture efforts under the heading of critical thinking. And the theory of truth is a subcategory of the theory of knowledge. And so we have spent some time dealing with that, and now we are in the middle of this issue that we call the theory of truth, which particularly important today. It is, I think, actually, the theory of truth is, in my view, the most important thing that we have to consider as we continually explore this whole issue of critical thinking. And now keep in mind, this is something that we have said before, which is we are now on a collision course with destiny. Whether you like it or not, that's the reality that we face currently in the world today. Because of that, if you know how to think critically, then teach it to others. If you do not know how to think critically, then learn. And that is our biggest challenge today, is not only is to learn how to think critically, because that is the primary weapon that we are going to use to get through this this world in turmoil, this world crisis, where we are bombarded with falsifications. We are bombarded with lies and distortions and fake this and fake that and deceptions. We are overwhelmed with efforts and initiatives designed to deceive. Our weapon against all of this is critical thinking. So, again, if you know how to think critically, then teach it to others. If you do not know how to think critically, then learn. And we're not talking about learn when you can get to it in your busy day. I'm talking about you drop everything. I'm sorry. This is pretty critical. This is mission critical. You drop everything and you start learning how to think critically. Maybe you can still eat, but that's pretty much it. Eat and drink and start learning on a regular basis how to think critically. Along that line, we have recommended on this show many times to start your own critical thinking discussion group and do it at the local level. And this is not an option. This now is actually something that is required. This is not an option. Okay. With respect to that, why are we dealing with this other issue? And it's not another issue. It is a related issue. It's a directly related issue. Because when we embrace critical thinking, all kinds of things pop up on the radar. All kinds of things become relevant to us as we move forward. One of the things that we're dealing with right now is called the theory of truth. How do we know that something that is claimed to be true is in fact true? How do we know that? Are we just a victim of this effort to deceive, or do we have the ability, do we have the capacity to actually determine if a claim is in fact true? We have that ability, and it comes from our ability to reason. We are invoking our power of reason. I have claimed on this show and in other places that your power of reason is the most important aspect of our existence. It is the most powerful thing, in my view, in the universe. Your power of reason is, in fact, the most powerful thing in the universe. I know that sounds crazy. That sounds way, way like almost like Kevin has gone over the edge now, and Kevin is delusional, and Kevin is not in touch with reality. Well, I beg to differ. I beg to differ strongly. Our power of reason is the most powerful thing in the universe. Do not hand that over to anyone, including me. It is yours. You own it. Own your power of reason. Nurture it. Keep it with you all the time. Never, ever let it go. Never relinquish your power of reason. Never believe something just because someone else said it. Make up your own mind about everything in your life. How do we know then, with respect to the power of reason, how do we know if, in fact, something that claims to be true is, in fact, true? How do we know that? What kinds of things can we consider? What kinds of things within this thing we call the power of reason, what are the things that we can bring forward and use to consider whether or not this thing is true? What is the test for truth? Okay, the test for truth is not a single point solution. And remember, in the last few episodes that we have recorded and that's available in podcast form, we talked about the truth algorithm. And this is part of what we're dealing with. We are building the truth algorithm. We're actually going to build it. All right? You say that, well, never heard of it before. Has it ever been done? And so forth and so on. I would suggest that no, it has never been done before at any place that I'm aware of. There is a theory of truth, which is an aspect of the theory of knowledge. Those two things are alive in the marketplace of ideas, and you can find them fairly easily, as I have. Okay, but is there, in fact, a cognitive process and performance aid that can help you determine if something is true? Is there a truth algorithm? We are proposing here that there is a truth algorithm, and we are in the midst of building it over these last recent episodes of Throttle Up. This episode, we are going to continue to build on this truth algorithm. One of the things that we are going to address, which is crucial in our ability to create this truth algorithm, is crucial, is our power of intuition. Our power of intuition is, in fact, a major component of our power of reason. Intuition is something. Do we employ intuition? Is something intuitive? Do we consider, okay, given this and given that, what is my intuition telling me? Do I have an intuitive feel that this thing is true, or do I have an intuitive feel that this thing is not true, that this thing can't possibly be true? It just does not. It just does not pass my intuition discovery process. If we are going to employ intuition for us to uncover or to discover if something is viable, if something is accurate, if something is actual, if something is true, that is a powerful tool at our disposal. One of the things that I have learned in my life as a professional aviator and fighter pilot is this. Your first impression is almost always correct. There is something that goes on in your mind. There's something that goes on that we call intuition. It also goes by a number of other names, so it's a little bit difficult to define. There is, in fact, a psychological definition of it, but it relates to our ability to consider something out there that that is forward in time from the present. So intuition usually has to do with something that will occur or could occur sometime in the future. So it's a futuristic projection of something or other. And this futuristic projection is often referred to as intuition. Also, that's a part of one psychological profile. Some people that if you were tested psychologically, and typically this is done with the Myers-Briggs instrument, if you're tested psychologically, you can be. You can figure out if, in fact, you are an intuitive thinker. I happen to be an intuitive thinker. I have been tested utilizing the Myers-Briggs testing instrument, and I am an intuitive thinker, as many of us are. Not everyone is, but a significant number of humans are, in fact, intuitive. Can you develop that? Sure. You know, the brain and the mind is not static. There's a term called neuroplasticity. There is also other kinds of things going on, and we don't quite understand it, but the mind and the brain are living, evolving things on a regular basis. And so we can, in fact, invoke intuition. All right, so what we're going to do right now, we are going to play this short audio clip.
This show, in the interest of accuracy, will cease referring to the White House or anything associated with it, the entire executive branch of government, as the, quote, Biden administration. And the reason we're changing is not to make a statement, but merely to reflect reality. Joe Biden, whatever his merits as a human being, has no active role in running the U.S. government. Everyone knows that, everyone pretends otherwise, but it's true. And so henceforth, we will refer to it as the administration, the White House, the Kamala Harris administration, the third and far more radical Obama administration.
Fox News host Tucker Carlson there arguing Joe Biden has no active role in running the government. Carlson says he will no longer refer to the executive branch as the Biden administration because he thinks Joe Biden is no longer capable of doing anything and is not in charge. Today we saw President Biden abruptly cut off press questions because if he kept answering, he would be in trouble. Biden answered a few shouted questions from gathered reporters at the White House after he spoke on the new COVID-19 guidelines.
I'm sorry, this is the last question I'll take, and I'm really going to be in trouble.
And while it wasn't clear what Biden actually meant by that, he is known for his gaffes during these media press conferences. Twitter was quick to react to Biden's comment. Lindsay wrote, "Who will Biden get in trouble with for taking press questions? He's the president." And Jake said, "Can't get over when Biden takes questions and keeps saying, 'I'm going to get in trouble,' when he is the president of the United States." It's no secret since Biden came into office almost 100 days ago that he has been more reserved with the press. In comparison to Donald Trump, who loved to speak to large crowds, Biden has very limited engagements with the media. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki often receives questions from frustrated reporters about the government's lack of transparency on issues and the lack of access overall to Biden.
Okay, so that is a bombshell moment. I think that the fact that Tucker Carlson has stated this on a mainstream media platform, Fox News, and Sky News has picked it up, and we were playing an audio clip of the Sky News discussion of this bombshell event. And so they are as much concerned about it as the Tucker Carlson show. I think this is the bombshell moment. Now, this brings up all kinds of things that let's assume. Okay, the first thing is that we know that Tucker Carlson does not believe that Joe Biden is in charge of the executive branch of the government. We know that. He does not believe that. Okay. So the first order of business is to consider that for the moment. Let's do a thought experiment. And let's consider that with respect to the theory of truth and this thing that we call intuition. We are on the intuitive branch of the truth algorithm. What does our intuition tell us if, in fact, there are a number of people, notable people, there are maybe a growing number of people who believe what Tucker Carlson has just said? And we can even go so far as to stay completely abstract and say, okay, given that that is true for the moment, let's do a thought experiment. Given that Joe Biden is, in fact, not in charge of the executive branch of the government, then what is the implication of that? What does that mean to the average American citizen? What does that mean to a government worker? What does that mean to a private business? What does that mean to the Defense Department? What does that mean to the Justice Department? What does that mean across the board? What exactly does that mean? Okay, the first thing that comes to mind is, okay, if in fact that is true, that Biden is no longer in charge of the government, then who is the commander-in-chief of the armed forces of the United States? Who is in charge of the military? And we can go even higher up. We can say, okay, if Biden is not in charge, then who is? And we can say the who could be a single individual or a group of individuals acting as a organized entity. I would like to know who is in charge if Biden is not in charge. And so the first order of business is, okay, where are the investigative reporters? Right now, we do not just have to stay in mental limbo. We can use our power of intuition here. If, in fact, Biden is not in charge, intuitively, we can then consider, or we can intuitively conclude that somebody else is in charge. And whoever that is, whoever somebody else is, or it could be a group acting in unison, they do not want to be identified. So we are being ruled by a secret organization. They want to remain secret. Maybe they're not exactly secret, but they want to remain secret. And why is that? The first order of business here is that we have got to determine who is in fact in charge. And if Biden is not in charge, who is in fact the commander in chief? What individual? It has to be an individual, not a group. This is not a group run country. There are specific people that head up certain organizations. The commander in chief is the top dog in the military. The commander in chief heads up the defense establishment in this country of ours. Who is that then? Who is running the country if Biden is not in charge? And the other thing is that if Biden is not in charge, and this is really crucial here for all of us critical thinkers, if Biden is not in charge, how did he get there in the first place? How was he elected if he winds up not being in charge? Was he legitimately elected in a normally functioning, verifiably accurate election system? Was he elected, legitimately elected the president of the United States, even though he is not functioning in that capacity? Now, what does your intuition tell you? And this is crucial. It does your intuition tell you that somebody who is actually not functioning as the president of the United States was actually elected as the president of the United States? Now, was he elected as the president of the United States so that he could occupy the office without actually being in charge? Does that make any sense to anybody? Now, if it does make sense to anyone out there in the listening audience, then my brain is going to start to hurt rather seriously, because that can't possibly make any sense to anyone. Use your intuition. What is your intuition telling you? That somebody was actually legitimately elected to the president's, as the president of the United States, to occupy the office as a figurehead, to occupy the office such that he is actually not the one in charge. How exactly did that happen? In the history of this country, if in fact we take what Tucker Carlson has said as a accurate depiction of the truth, then for the first time in the history of the United States of America, a person was elected to be a figurehead president without having the authority as specified in the Constitution of the United States. So someone else is actually the president, but whoever is acting as the person or persons in charge was in fact not elected. Now, what is going on here? Does that make any intuitive sense to anybody who those people or that person who is actually running the government was in fact not elected to do so? Okay. Therefore, is that constitutional? Is that situation that we find ourselves in legal in terms of what we understand to be our system of justice in this great country of ours? Is it legal? Does it make any sense whatsoever to the average American? And I would say that we have now entered a realm of thought in which nothing that is being proposed makes any sense to anyone. Okay. What we have to do now is we have to consider something along the way with respect to our power of reason, our ability to engage intuition. We have to consider that we are encountering a phenomena which we call mass psychosis. And we are going to examine that right now because we have now entered this realm of a psychological minefield here where mass psychosis could, in fact, take over and ultimately destroy everything that we have built. So let's listen to this from the Academy of Ideas.
The masses have never thirsted after truth. They turn aside from evidence that is not to their taste, preferring to deify error if error seduce them. Whoever can supply them with illusions is easily their master. Whoever attempts to destroy their illusions is always their victim. Diseases of the body can spread through a population and reach epidemic proportions, but so too can diseases of the mind. And of these epidemics of the latter variety, the mass psychosis is the most dangerous. During a mass psychosis, madness becomes the norm in a society, and delusionary beliefs spread like a contagion. But as delusions can take many forms, and as madness can manifest in countless ways, the specific manner in which a mass psychosis unfolds will differ based on the historical and cultural context of the infected society. In the past, mass psychoses have led to witch hunts, genocides, and even dancing manias. But in the modern era, it is the mass psychosis of totalitarianism that is the greatest threat. Totalitarianism, writes Arthur Verslewis, is the modern phenomenon of total centralized state power, coupled with the obliteration of individual human rights. In the totalized state, there are those in power, and there are the objectified masses, the victims. In a totalitarian society, the population is divided into two groups, the rulers and the ruled, and both groups undergo a pathological transformation. The rulers are elevated to an almost godlike status, which is diametrically opposed to our nature as imperfect beings who are easily corrupted by power. The masses, on the other hand, are transformed into the dependent subjects of these pathological rulers and take on a psychologically regressed and childlike status. Hannah Arendt, one of the 20th century's preeminent scholars of this form of rule, called totalitarianism an attempted transformation of human nature itself. But this attempted transformation only turns sound minds into sick minds, for as the Dutch medical doctor who studied the mental effects of living under totalitarianism wrote, "There is in fact much that is comparable between the strange reactions of the citizens of totalitarianism and their culture as a whole, on the one hand, and the reactions of the sick schizophrenic on the other." The social transformation that unfolds under totalitarianism is built upon and sustained by delusions. For only deluded men and women regress to the childlike status of obedient and submissive subjects and hand over complete control of their lives to politicians and bureaucrats. Only a deluded ruling class will believe that they possess the knowledge, wisdom, and acumen to completely control society in a top-down manner, and only when under the spell of delusions would anyone believe that a society composed of power-hungry rulers, on the one hand, and a psychologically regressed population, on the other, will lead to anything other than mass suffering and social ruin. But what triggers the psychosis of totalitarianism? As was explored in the previous video of this series, the mass psychosis of totalitarianism begins in a society's ruling class. The individuals that make up this class, be it politicians, bureaucrats, or crony capitalists, are very prone to delusions that augment their power, and no delusion is more attractive to the power-hungry than the delusion that they can and should control and dominate a society. When a ruling elite becomes possessed by a political ideology of this sort, be it communism, fascism, or technocracy, the next step is to induce a population into accepting their rule by infecting them with the mass psychosis of totalitarianism. This psychosis has been induced many times throughout history, and as Mirlu explains, it is simply a question of reorganizing and manipulating collective feelings in the proper way. The general method by which the members of a ruling elite can accomplish this end is called menticide, with the etymology of this word being a killing of the mind, and as Mirlu further explains, menticide is an old crime against the human mind and spirit, but systematized anew. It is an organized system of psychological intervention and judicial perversion through which a ruling class can imprint their own opportunistic thoughts upon the minds of those they plan to use and destroy. Priming a population for the crime of menticide begins with the sowing of fear. For as was explored in the first video of this series, when an individual is flooded with negative emotions such as fear or anxiety, he or she is very susceptible to a descent into the delusions of madness. Threats, real, imagined, or fabricated, can be used to sow fear, but a particularly effective technique is to use waves of terror. Under this technique, the sowing of fear is staggered with periods of calm, but each of these periods of calm is followed by the manufacturing of an even more intense spell of fear, and on, the process goes. Or as Mirlu writes, each wave of terrorizing creates its effects more easily after a breathing spell than the one that preceded it, because people are still disturbed by their previous experience. Morality becomes lower and lower, and the psychological effects of each new propaganda campaign become stronger. It reaches a public already softened up. While fear primes a population for menticide, the use of propaganda to spread misinformation and to promote confusion with respect to the source of the threats and the nature of the crisis helps to break down the minds of the masses. Government officials and their lackeys in the media can use contradictory reports, nonsensical information, and even blatant lies, as the more they confuse, the less capable will a population be to cope with the crisis and diminish their fear in a rational and adaptive manner. Confusion, in other words, heightens the susceptibility of a descent into the delusions of totalitarianism. Or as Mirlu explains, logic can be met with logic, while illogic cannot. It confuses those who think straight. The big lie and monotonously repeated nonsense have more emotional appeal than logic and reason. While the people are still searching for a reasonable counterargument to the first lie, the totalitarians can assault them with another. Never before in history have such effective means existed to manipulate a society into the psychosis of totalitarianism. Smartphones and social media, television and the internet, all in conjunction with algorithms that quickly censor the flow of unwanted information, allow those in power to easily assault the minds of the masses. What is more, the addictive nature of these technologies means that many people voluntarily subject themselves to the ruling elite's propaganda with a remarkable frequency. Modern technology, explains Mirlu, teaches man to take for granted the world he is looking at. He takes no time to retreat and reflect. Technology lures him on, dropping him into its wheels and movements. No rest, no meditation, no reflection, no conversation. The senses are continually overloaded with stimuli. Man doesn't learn to question his world anymore. The screen offers him answers, ready-made. But there is a further step the would-be totalitarian rulers can take to increase the chance of a totalitarian psychosis. And this is to isolate the victims and to disrupt normal social interactions. When alone and lacking normal interactions with friends, family, and co-workers, an individual becomes far more susceptible to delusions for several reasons. Firstly, they lose contact with the corrective force of the positive example, for not everyone is tricked by the machinations of the ruling elite, and the individuals who see through the propaganda can help free others from the menticidal assault. If, however, isolation is enforced, the power of these positive examples greatly diminishes. But another reason that isolation increases the efficacy of menticide is because, like many other species, human beings are more easily conditioned into new patterns of thought and behavior when isolated. Or as Mirlu explains with regards to the physiologist Ivan Pavlov's work on behavioral conditioning, Pavlov made another significant discovery. The conditioned reflex could be developed most easily in a quiet laboratory with a minimum of disturbing stimuli. Every trainer of animals knows this from his own experience. Isolation and the patient repetition of stimuli are required to tame wild animals. The totalitarians have followed this rule. They know that they can condition their political victims most quickly if they are kept in isolation. Alone, confused, and battered by waves of terror, a population under an attack of menticide descends into a hopeless and vulnerable state. The never-ending stream of propaganda turns minds once capable of rational thought into playhouses of irrational forces. And with chaos swirling around them and within them, the masses crave a return to a more ordered world. The would-be totalitarians can now take the decisive step. They can offer a way out and a return to order in a world that seems to be moving rapidly in the opposite direction. But all this comes at a price. The masses must give up their freedom and cede control of all aspects of life to the ruling elite. They must relinquish their capacity to be self-reliant individuals who are responsible for their own lives and become submissive and obedient subjects. The masses, in other words, must descend into the delusions of the totalitarian psychosis. Totalitarianism, writes Mirlu, is man's escape from the fearful realities of life into the virtual womb of the leaders. The individual's actions are directed from this womb, from the inner sanctum. Man need no longer assume responsibility for his own life. The order and logic of the prenatal world reign. There is peace and silence, the peace of utter submission. But the order of a totalitarian world is a pathological order. By enforcing a strict conformity and requiring a blind obedience from the citizenry, totalitarianism rids the world of the spontaneity that produces many of life's joys and the creativity that drives society forward. The total control of this form of rule, no matter under what name it is branded, be it rule by scientists and doctors, politicians and bureaucrats, or a dictator, breeds stagnation, destruction, and death on a mass scale. And so perhaps the most important question facing the world is how can totalitarianism be prevented? And if a society has been induced into the early stages of this mass psychosis, can the effects be reversed? While one can never be sure of the prognosis of a collective madness, there are steps that can be taken to help effectuate a cure. This task, however, necessitates many different approaches from many different people. For just as the menticidal attack is multi-pronged, so too must be the counterattack. According to Carl Jung, for those of us who wish to help return sanity to an insane world, the first step is to bring order to our own minds and to live in a way that provides inspiration for others to follow. It is not for nothing that our age cries out for the redeemer personality, for the one who can emancipate himself from the grip of the collective psychosis and save at least his own soul, who lights a beacon of hope for others, proclaiming that here is at least one man who has succeeded in extricating himself from the fatal identity with the group psyche. But assuming one is living in a manner free of the grip of the psychosis, there are further steps that can be taken. Information that counters the propaganda should be spread as far and as wide as possible. For the truth is more powerful than the fiction and falsities peddled by the would-be totalitarian rulers. And so their success is in part contingent on their ability to censor the free flow of information. Another tactic is to use humor and ridicule to delegitimize the ruling elite, or as Mirlu explains, we must learn to treat the demagogue and aspirant dictators in our midst with the weapon of ridicule. The demagogue himself is almost incapable of humor of any sort, and if we treat him with humor, he will begin to collapse. A tactic recommended by Vaclav Havel, a political dissident under Soviet communist rule, who later became president of Czechoslovakia, is the construction of what are called parallel structures. A parallel structure is any form of organization, business, institution, technology, or creative pursuit that exists physically within a totalitarian society, yet morally outside of it. In communist Czechoslovakia, Havel noted that these parallel structures were more effective at combating totalitarianism than political action. Furthermore, when enough parallel structures are created, a second culture, or parallel society, spontaneously forms and functions as an enclave of freedom and sanity within a totalitarian world. Or as Havel explains in his book, The Power of the Powerless. What else are parallel structures than an area where a different life can be lived? A life that is in harmony with its own aims, and which in turn structures itself in harmony with those aims. What else are those initial attempts at social self-organization than the efforts of a certain part of society to rid itself of the self-sustaining aspects of totalitarianism, and thus, to extricate itself radically from its involvement in the totalitarian system? But above all else, what is required to prevent a full descent into the madness of totalitarianism is action by as many people as possible. For just as the ruling elite do not sit around passively, but instead take deliberate steps to increase their power, so too an active and concerted effort must be made to move the world back in the direction of freedom. This can be an immense challenge in a world falling prey to the delusions of totalitarianism, but as Thomas Paine noted, tyranny, like hell, is not easily conquered. Yet we have this consolation with us, that the harder the conflict, the more glorious the triumph.
Okay, so here we have group psychosis. Now, that's from the Academy of Ideas, and I would recommend that to anyone who is intellectually curious about what we are trying to deal with in this series of shows and podcasts that have to deal with, to keep it simple, is the theory of truth. How do we know something is true? And are we, in fact, moving toward this group psychosis? Are we actually in a arena where we have encountered group psychosis? And what's the antidote? What is the polar opposite of group psychosis? What is the counterpart of group psychosis? The counterpart of group psychosis, in my view, is a society, the members of the society, the members of the culture that can actually think critically. Group psychosis is brought about through the process of fear. Somehow fear has invaded the consciousness of the people occupying this country, this group, this society, or even this world. Fear is the mechanism by which psychosis emerges. Psychosis then becomes something that can be exploited by the controlling class, by those people who want to control all aspects of humanity. So group psychosis then is the result, and that is desired by the many, by the groups that aspire to control all aspects of the human existence. So the controllers want group psychosis that is brought about through the imposition, if that is a correct word, or the ability to inject into the consciousness a state of fear. So apparently, and I say this in a way that I don't want to sound like I'm completely delusional, but apparently this state of fear is manufactured. It is not a naturally occurring thing. There are certain events that have been put in place that are intentionally designed to create fear within the population. I have often seen this quote from the controllers. They have stated in their conferences and discussions that if you can get people to become afraid, you can get them to agree to almost anything. So fear is the mechanism by which they intervene into human affairs and take over control of the human population. The antidote to that, the counter tactic, if you will, or even we can say the defense. We have defenses against that. The defense against all of that is the ability to think critically. So once again, if you know how to think critically, then teach it to others. This is not something right now that I would consider to be optional. I would consider that to be a requirement. If you know how to think critically, teach it to others. If you don't know how to think critically, then learn and start learning today. There's lots of resources that you can use. There is my book, Critical Thinking Essentials. That's a good starting point. There are many other published material that you can access, as well as video material, instructional videos on the subject. We talked a little bit about that earlier in the show. That's one way that you can learn, and learn we all must. And then we are prepared to avoid these pitfalls that have been placed before us. Okay, I can see that I'm at another end of another Throttle Up Radio show. Thank you so much for being here, and we will see you all next week.